4:55 on October 7th. All right. Questions to begin with? I'm planning the last week of October. I have to be out of town for all of those classes, all three of them. So one of them will be an exam review. One of them will be an exam, and I'll have Vic do the third one. And I don't remember exactly what the schedule is. I think the exam is either Wednesday or Friday. You can look at the schedule and see which one it is. I don't remember. I get confused between two classes that happen one right after another. I can't keep track. Anyway, so we're looking to an exam at the end of October, in that week, Wednesday or Friday. I will post an assignment from the problems in the book later this afternoon. So keep an eye open for that. Probably about a 10-day due date on that. And then overlapping with that, there's going to be another programming project that will be a longer period. But it will overlap with that. So I'll still working on getting those done. So, but they'll be showing up here shortly. Any questions about logistics here or anything else? Good. Okay. Well, yes.
Did you record on Monday?
I did, and I posted it this morning. Yeah, I was slower than usual, but it did get done. It's there now. So today we're going to talk about the way addressing works in IP version 4, and we'll see whether we get all the way to IP version 6 or not. This will sort of wrap up the sort of conceptual description of what's going on, and then remaining is the description of routing, where we get into algorithms and so on and so forth. So, this is terminology. This is sort of book learning stuff, and this is more programming stuff. I like that later stuff. So we'll try to get to it rapidly. Okay. So I think we've said before that IP addresses are 32-bit identifiers. Also said before that they're, you know, although we commonly think of them as being associated with a host, they're actually, in truth, associated with a host network interface. That is the hardware bit that connects the computer to the network. It's possible hosts these days to have more than one interface. I think the book has not really caught up to the world of laptop computers that plug into Ethernets and wireless networks at the same time. Each of those is a separate network interface. And if you hook up a modem, that can be a third one. Each of them has its own IP address. And I was going to say that some Linux systems seem not to have caught up with the idea that computers have multiple network interfaces either. Not that Linux can't handle it, but some of the tools are not so good at it. Okay, so we've got 32 bits to play with, right? We've got 1, 2, 3, 4 bytes, and those are each 8 bits. And the way that network addressing works in the internet is that we sort of artificially distinguish between some part of these, which are the so-called subnet address, and the other part, which is called
the host address.
Okay, so we split up those 32 bits into two fields. The high order part is the subnet address, the low order part is the host address, and the boundary between the two is actually a variable. It's something that is different in different situations. So one thing that the book is pretty good about is helping understand what is a subnet. And it's a nice little mnemonic device. Basically, the idea is divorce each interface from the host it's attached to and look at everything that is then connected. All right? So in this example, what's connected here is a subnet below, a different subnet to the left, and a third one to the right. Okay? The key concept is everything on a single subnet is reachable from within that subnet without involving any routers. That's the key distinguishing thing. And you can achieve that by disconnecting the interfaces from the router, and then the router can't work, right? So it gets a little confusing if you have a host that has multiple interfaces and is acting like a router. You have to remember to disconnect those two. I mean, it still counts as a router even if it's a host. Like if you're doing network sharing under Windows, right? Internet connection sharing under Windows, your Windows machine is actually acting as a router in that case, and you've got a subnet outside and you've got a subnet inside. What was different about this? I don't know. Okay, we did that. Oh, this one's a little interesting. If you have routers hooked together with point-to-point links, each of those point-to-point links in turn is a subnet unto itself. It's obvious from the rule. Okay, so today, as of the sort of mid-1990s, we live in a world where IP addressing is done with something called CIDR. This is pronounced CIDR, like the Apple stuff. And it stands for Classless Inter-Domain Routing. And the idea here is that in different situations, we can move the boundary between the host part and the subnet part. We always write addresses for subnets as give some address on the subnet and then say how many bits make up the subnet portion. So the example here is we've taken one more bit than the last byte for the host address, so this is a type 20/23 subnet. Okay? It's just a bit of notation. There's an older notation that is based on what's called the subnet mask, where we actually say what the bits are that are part of the address. So this one would be 255.255.254. Okay? So if you think about what these are as hex values, right? This is FF, FF, FE. Those are one bit. Those are a contiguous set of one bits, right? There are 23 of them. And they make up the parts of the address that are part of the subnet. With me? Okay. Not hard, just terminology. Oh, well, I don't know if the slides go back to this. I don't remember. The reason it's called classless interdomain routing is that in the original days of the internet, there was a subnetting scheme that only had fixed boundaries between the subnet part and the host part. There were class A addresses. Class A corresponded to a /8 network. B was a 16, and a C was a 24. Type addressing scheme. The problem is that a network with 16 million hosts, which is what you get when you throw away the 8 bits for the network, is just too big, right? And so it has to be broken down further. And for the purposes of assigning addresses, this scheme just sort of ran out of gas because it was forcing you to have networks that were either too small or too big. Right? So it's much more common to see like /22s as the basic network that's often used these days. We'll just say /22 is popular. How do we get an IP address? You can hard code it on the host. I don't know what this is. That's not where it typically goes in a Unix machine. Different Unix systems have different schemes for where to assign it statically. So there is, I would say, there's no typical place that you put it on a Unix machine. You have to look up the documentation for the system you have. So these days, apart from servers and other machines that sort of need to always stay in the same place, it's much more common to use what's called the Dynamic Host Configuration Protocol, which is a application layer protocol that runs on IP networks. It involves doing broadcasts when a host first comes up and getting back an assignment from a DHCP server of the address that host should have on that network. And the server keeps track of what all the other hosts are on the network. Can often be configured so that it consistently assigns the same address to the same host. We'll see that there's link layer information that identifies a host directly so that it can be consistent in its mapping, and that's handy. This is the way that typically Windows and Linux laptops and other machines are configured these days. It's very convenient. Instead of having to call up your system administrator on the phone, have him recite some numbers that mean nothing to the average office worker, tell them to navigate menus in Windows or Unix to plop in this number. Instead, you just plug in the machine and it works. Now, say one more thing about this. The assignment of IP addresses has to be done consistent with the subnet into which the machine is actually attached. Right? So you can't just pick an arbitrary number. You have to pick one that belongs to that subnet. We'll save that for later. Okay, so here's how it works. There's a DHCP discover message that is broadcast. the server replies with an offer message. The host then requests the thing that was offered, and eventually the server sends back an acknowledgement that the request was received, and that's the host permission to begin using that IP address. This discover offer thing, where it broadcasts for the broadcasts the discover message, is just because, or partly because, these addresses are given out with a fixed period of time over which they're valid, and when that time is coming to an end, the host has to do a renewal to have permission to continue using the same IP address, and it can do that by requesting a specific address. It knows at that point where the server is, and it can ask for that same address again, so it doesn't have to change. That's convenient if other machines need to reach this one. If you have to change the IP address, all the connections you have are going to break and things like that. So that's not fun. Yeah. Doesn't matter.
Wireshark one time, it seemed like every so many minutes it was checking like the zero address to see if it could take it or something. If I remember it.
Whoa. The zero address is not valid for a host.
The last field?
Yeah. Okay. Is not valid for a host. It's used for broadcast. So. Pardon?
It's probably doing a broadcast before we saw.
So you may be seeing somebody actually doing an operation that involves that address, right? What you may have been seeing is the host using that broadcast address.
Okay.
Okay. As opposed to asking for it.
It seems
like it,
the
well, okay. Yeah, that's kind of curious. Okay, well, this just illustrates what we saw. My, he does go on about this. I get, well, this will actually, okay. So, let's see. Makes a request by doing a broadcast to the all ones address. The DHCP server replies with an offer of a particular address. I'm bothered by this. My recollection is that these messages don't happen as broadcasts. No.
Yeah. How would each host know who the server's talking to?
I know what's happened. I think what happens here is that, in fact, yes, they do use those broadcast address, but they do it with the link layer addresses that are host specific. The MAC addresses, yeah. So it may look like this as far as an IP packet, but it gets sent as a non-broadcast Ethernet. I'm not sure. I think we should investigate this with Wireshark at some point. So that might be a good problem. See what we see when we look for DHCP traffic. Okay, so how do you get the subnet part of the IP address? How does the DHCP server learn what subnet parts it should be handing out to all the machines on the same physical network? There are really two ways that happens. One is described here. I don't know if we have a slide for the other one. But a service provider gets assigned some big block of addresses here. So this service provider owns a network space that begins with those 20 bits, and so it has 12 bits left over, so 4,000 addresses that it can hand out. It can hand out subpieces of its space by giving different subscribers somewhat longer prefixes that fall within its space. So in organization 2 here, let's look at that. It's got the next three bits are set for it, for that organization. And so this is a type 23 address. This organization 2 has 512 addresses available to it, 9 bits worth. Okay? And the ISP can carve those up any way it wants. It just has to be consistent so that it doesn't hand out overlapping blocks. That would be a bad thing. Okay. The other way that you can get addresses is if you're a big enough organization, you can actually go to the national organization called ARIN, A-R-I-N, that hands out blocks to the ISPs. If you're big enough, you can sort of act like an ISP and get your hands on a bigger block maybe than the ISP can give you. Okay. So in this same scenario, which I think is consistent here, yeah, 223. What is this? 223, 16. Oh, it says so right there. Gosh. In this same scenario, on the next slide, then, how do we get messages to these subnets now? So now the subnets get connected to the internet. We have to tell the routing system where the subnets are. Right? So at the point where each network attaches into the internet, we have to say, we're taking all traffic that looks like that, right? 223.16.0/23, that's me, right? That's all the traffic that looks like that needs to come to me. There can't be any that goes anywhere else in the internet. It needs to come to me. Organization 1 is going to have an address that looks like this with .18, and 2 is .20, and 7 is .30. These are all subparts of the ISP's address space, and each of them tells the ISP, that's me, or the ISP tells them that that's them. Okay, but somehow or other, the ISP knows that this kind of traffic goes here. Now, all of these together, though, are contiguous, right? They're if we just carve off a few more bits for the host part of the address, go back here. Looking back here, everything in this subnet, the /20 subnet, belongs to our ISP. So the ISP doesn't have to tell the world individually about all 7 of these. He can just say, give me everything for 223.16.0/20. Right? He doesn't have to propagate information about all his subscribers out into the world. Well, this turns out to be important because The more of these routes that get pushed out into the internet and into the backbone, the more expensive the routers get, because they have to process, they have to hold more routes, and they have to process more routes for every packet, which makes them a greater computational challenge as well. Okay? Does that make sense to everybody? It's called route aggregation. Now, suppose that, let's go back here. Suppose that organization one here says, I no longer like my ISP. I want to switch to ISPs or us. Okay, so we'll break that connection and hook him up over there. The question is, does that force us to advertise all seven other routes individually? Or is there some trick we could do to so that we don't have to do that? And the next slide shows us the trick that's involved so we don't have to do that. Fly-by-night here continues to say, give me all the traffic for the 223.16.0 space. But ISPs are us says, I want stuff that looks like a 200.23.18.0/23. So this, that'll go back now. Oh, darn it. I hate it when I do that. That is just so, anybody remember what page number we were on? I have no idea. That came out pretty close. Okay. So, who did we move? We moved 18, I think, didn't we? Yeah, we moved 18. So, look at the addresses for the 18 network. They look just like the ones for the 16 network, except that they extend by another 3 bits. Okay? So, in the absence of anything else, the traffic for the 18 network would continue to come up to this fly-by-night ISP, but the rule is actually, if you have a routing entry that is longer and matches, you prefer that one. So out here in the world, we still have the .16.0/20 rule, routing rule, but we also have one that says 223.18.0 and is 23 bits long. That's longer, so it wins in the case that you have traffic coming to this network. So instead of having to being forced by this small change to propagate all seven of these routes plus this one, we still propagate one route for all of these and just one for this. Okay. And you can think about the balancing act that occurs when these things show up in different patterns. If we take every other one of these and assign it to somebody else, we're going to end up with sort of four extra ones. But there are other patterns that we could do that would, if we moved contiguous ones over here, then we could change the rules appropriately so that we'd be aggregating over here as well. Okay. So I mentioned Aaron before. ICON is the international organization at the very top level that assigns that hands out addresses. It manages the top level DNS, you know, the ones the so-called root domain name servers that know where things like COM and EDU and BIS are served from. And it has a lot of sort of politics involved in this, because things like domain names domain names are words, and words can be used as trademarks and thereby protected, and so domain names may be protectable as trademarks, but trademark law says that two companies that are in completely different businesses can use the same trademark, but that won't work in the internet because it has to be unique. So there's sort of conflicts around names and numbers, and that's what ICON is all about. Okay, so we've talked about how addresses get assigned with the idea that they're going to be sort of globally known addresses in the internet. Most of us these days don't live in a world where most of our machines are actually globally accessible over the internet. They have what's known as a network address translation assigned address. The reason for this is that there got to be too many hosts in the internet, and that 32-bit address space, which can serve 4 billion hosts, if used completely efficiently, was filling up. And so people came up with a scheme whereby machines could, a single device attached to the internet could essentially share it, a single IP address with many other hosts on the other side. So this is called a network address translation device. The devices attached to it on the so-called private network side get assigned addresses that come from a few places in that 32-bit address space that are specifically reserved for this kind of use. And the reservation takes the form of called private IP space. And routes never appear. Appear in the internet. Okay? So there's never a route out in the main internet that says, I know how to get to a 10.0 address. That whole space starting with 10 actually is reserved as private IP space. So an organization can use the, what are they, what did I say, 16 million host addresses in that space any way it wants to. It just can't ever send packets out with those as the source address and expect to get back any replies, because there are no routes to there. Sitting in between is a box called a network address translation box that translates these addresses so that it looks like packets coming from anywhere in here come from the single IP address. Okay? And to do that, it has to do machinations on the port numbers as well as the addresses, because suppose I were sending something from say, port 80 here, and he's sending something from port 80 there, and we're going to different destinations, well, the NAT box has to make sure that replies that come back to the two of us go to different places. We can't both use port 80 as the outgoing port here. So, anyway, it works sort of okay. Problems show up when you actually want to have services running in here. Manufacturers of these NAT boxes typically give you the ability to say any traffic coming in on a particular port number here that you don't otherwise know about needs to go to a particular host here. So these boxes are what you, these NAT boxes are what you typically get when you buy a home router these days, for example. The ISPs mostly don't want you to have multiple routable IP addresses, and they will charge you appropriately if, in order to discourage you from doing that. You can do it, but not doesn't make them happy. Oh, so what else do you get from this? So one IP address. You're free to reconfigure your network in any way you like. Doesn't cause any problems. Host, that's cool. Yeah, we said that. Well, okay. So there is this sort of additional point here about, because you can't send messages directly to any of the hosts behind the NAT box, it's kind of a security plus, because the NAT box itself doesn't know what to do with them. They get rejected, and so they never show up on your Windows machine, which may be vulnerable, say. Okay. I think rather than talking through this, this is sort of, I described this generally about having to replace port numbers. Of course, you have to keep a table in the NAT box that tells you what you're doing. So it can be a bit of a slowdown process, especially when done with sort of very low-end hardware, like what you can buy in a $50 home router that has wireless too. You know, that's there's not a lot of dollars available here for hardware or engineering or anything else. It's a very, very cutthroat market. So the performance of these devices and the reliability of them, especially in the home situation, is in my experience, iffy. Anybody have experiences with that? I've bought these devices from several different people and several different manufacturers, and most of them, I would say, have gotten bollocksed up by the kind of traffic that I do at my house and the traffic that comes in over the internet. Pardon?
So I think I have too many devices on my router.
You have too many?
Oh yeah, I got like four roommates, I got like seven things.
Uh-huh.
You know, wired and then, you know,
wired and wireless and yeah. does it lock up every once in a while, or?
You know, I don't know if it's, well, it probably has, yeah. Should it lock up?
Yeah. That's kind of the behavior that I see.
They got dropped for some reason.
And so you turn off, you have to turn off the, when that happens, you turn off the router and turn it back on. Of course, it forgets everything that was going on, so all the DHCP stuff that it did is lost. The hosts start having address conflicts. It's just a cascade of misery. So. Well, this is an example. I think rather than talking through this, I'm going to give an assignment about this. That's that's better. That way you have to work through it. Oh, the controversy. Yeah, so there's a significant community in the internet, a significant subcommunity in the internet community that says NAT is a bad idea and we should never have done it. We should have just moved to IP version 6 instead to have enough addresses. And there's a sort of purist argument against NAT, which says that things that are router-like are only supposed to do manipulations on the IP header, right? Routers are not supposed to understand the transport protocols. Routers are not supposed to understand the application protocols. Therefore, NAT is bad because NAT involves translations on the port numbers in the transport headers. So that's the purest argument. The more practical argument, I think, is that NAT has forced a lot of cruft into application protocols to get around the problems caused by NAT making hosts, say, inaccessible. So, like, for example, Skype, has to maintain an outgoing connection all the time to somewhere, so that when somebody calls you, they can actually reach you. Right? Whereas your model of a phone number is, you know, your phone doesn't have to be sort of advertising its presence to the world. The world knows where your phone is, and so the world can call your phone. Whereas with NAT in place, since the host running Skype is not exposed to the internet, you can't just say, I'm here. You have to actually maintain that connection all the time to allow somebody to be able to reach you through the NAT box. Yeah, William?
So the anti-NAT people know what they wanted. Would that mean that essentially, say you had a home with like 7 hosts,
uh-huh. Each host would have its own IP address.
That would be provided by the ISP.
Provided by the ISP, yeah.
So how would they know how many addresses to give you?
You'd have to ask them.
Or to begin the computer, ask for new address.
Well, there are so many available there that they would be much more willing to hand them out in bigger chunks. So. Yeah, but yeah, we could probably have you know, easily 16 apiece, and nobody would care, and that would solve most people's problems for a long period of time. But I mean, I think the other bit of resistance about that is that it does promulgate a large number of routes. It causes there to have to be a large number of routes. And if the aggregation doesn't work well, then the expenses of the internet backbone go up to support just the routing in IPv6, not even considering the transition cost. But when you get there, it's more expensive. Oh, jeez. All right. Okay. Well, I'll give you some problems about NAT, and you can figure out what the ports do. Talking through it just doesn't seem productive. Okay, so the next topic here is the control message protocol. There are a bunch of them, a bunch of different types of messages. It's kind of a funny protocol. ICMP is a funny protocol in that it's above the network layer or above the IP layer, but it's still really part of the network. So it's like we've stratified the IP layer a bit and said that here's IP. All of this is network. Here's IP. And above that is ICMP. But it's still part of the network layer. So it has some characteristics of an application protocol. It doesn't really have any characteristics of a transport protocol, because the transport protocol's job is to sort of sit in between the network and the application, but just living right there inside it carries messages about how the network is working, basically. And you know, if you're familiar with ping, that's an ICMP type of activity. You can get back messages. At some point, when a packet reaches a router, it says, I'm going to that network, and the router says, I haven't got the slightest clue about that network. it can send back something that says, unreachable network. If it gets to the right router, but that router, for some reason, doesn't know how to reach a host, it can say, host unreachable. If it gets to a host and a port is not reachable, you can send back a message like that, an ICMP message. I think pretty much, so ping, unreachable, host unreachable. I've never seen a protocol unreachable. Port unreachable, those are all very commonly seen. This protocol, ICMP, got defined in the early days of the internet. They thought it might be useful to do some congestion control using ICMP. Well, we don't do that anymore. And finally, there are some routing messages, but I think those don't get used too much anymore. Anyway, so those, I think we have a slide of how they fit in. Darn, I wanted a picture. I'll make a picture for next time of how this fits together. Because it's kind of interesting. How do you fit something that is networky and application-y all into an IP framework without you know, there's specific numbers you have to use at various places, and I think it's worth going through that. Okay, I will get an assignment going here on figuring out some of this stuff so that you're actually actively doing it instead of listening to me talk about it. It's probably good. And take a look for that later this afternoon. Okay, thank you.